Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is May 12th, 2016 for most of us. And I am joined today by Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
I'm here.
Mr. Greg Lay.
Oh, hoy hoy, everyone.
We are not joined today by Mr. John Lindemann because he is watching his beloved San Jose Sharks play for Game 7 against the Nashville Predators. You know, the Canadian who roots for a hockey team from San Jose, California. John, I'm...
I don't think there's anything that strange about that myself, but there you go.
Well, to be fair, you don't have a hockey team, or in your case, an NFL team.
Not yet.
In your...
But even like, if they do eventually move a team to London, I ain't switching for anything. Nothing. They're
that's fine, but a Canadian rooting for a Southern hockey team feels bad. I mean, after his dramatic display of knowledge of U.S. history and his complete disregard for his home team's or his home nation's traditions, John is a man without a state.
You know what? No country for old men, you know.
It's not literal. Jeez. But today is episode 476. That in and of itself is not particularly special. It's just a number. However, when this episode comes out, it will be one day from the 10th anniversary of the very first episode of the, at the time, untitled Radio Free Nintendo. Mike and Evan, in a post-E3 blur, released a podcast on May 17th in 2006, covering things like the first time people got to use the Wii Remote and the highlight of the DS, like right as it was in its golden age. I'm not going to say it's an inauspicious episode. It was rough. It was very rough, and it was also very short.
It's pretty much like a two-part first episode, because it's the first episode deals with Wii stuff, and then the second part deals with DS stuff. And right. The second part is where it gets the title, Radio Free Nintendo, and all that. So, yeah. But they were much shorter back then, and it was two people, and it was very different. But that's how it all began. Just Mike Sklens and Evan Birchfield chatting a lot at E3, and it's got, hey, you should do this on the internet. But it just in terms of 10 years being so long ago, my favorite thing is looking back at the first talkback thread in RFN history, the one before that episode, where multiple people kind of expressed the sentiment of like, why is this in audio form? Yeah, what's good about that? and asking for a transcript, which someone actually provided, sort of the E3. Could you imagine transcribing the episodes today? That's practically like putting
not my job.
Yeah. No, so
kill me.
That is the wonderful kind of thing about just, you realize just how long ago that was. Yeah.
Conversely, can you imagine reading a transcript of the episodes today?
Yeah, no, I don't want to. Well, I don't want to. It's the more honest answer.
I mean, we'd get them in audiobook form. So, we're not doing a whole lot for this. We don't generally celebrate the year anniversaries. There was a time
it's drifted a lot. I mean, I think like maybe the first one was actually kind of celebrated on episode 51 rather than episode 50, you know, kind of. But ever since then, it's been a numerical episodes thing. And in a decade, you know, we've drifted off 50 episodes a year because there's sometimes weeks off, sometimes there's a bunch of unnumbered episodes that dominate the feed for certain weeks, whether it might be the telethon, whether it might be E3 and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, we are now still 24 episodes away from our next landmark episode, which we'll probably use for the occasion of nostalgia and all that stuff. But consider this the kickoff to this year's,
yes,
the celebrations of RFN's past.
I would say that when we first took over, Greg, you and I, Johnny and John, I think we may have like observed both to some degree, but by and large, we really took it to the round numbers because we had the episode 100 monstrosity.
Yeah.
That gargantuan thing that now actually ranks in. It's just kind of a slightly longer episode.
At the time, it was really something.
It was like 3 hours, I think, and
yeah.
Now, like, 2 hours is pretty standard, and we really should try to fix that, but it's hard. It's a difficult thing to do. But I want to thank both of you for joining me throughout this entire experience. It was terrifying, utterly terrifying, when I was asked to take the show over. And little did I know that Nintendo was going to make this even harder for us by having nothing to talk about. So look forward to the next 24 episodes where we try to get through it, and then we'll redo something for 500. Probably not as elaborate as 400, because 400 is obviously a much more significant number than 500.
Yeah,
or because Johnny was planning to leave before he told us and realized he wasn't going to make it to 500, so he was going to blow this shit out now.
That's some long-range thinking now. I'd be impressed if that were true.
Yeah, it's, God forbid the space engineer have any kind of long-range foresight. I do, before we get into new business, I do want to kind of commemorate 400 with a quick read. Kane writes, "Hello. I thought this would be an appropriate time to finally send this email due to the fact James called his viewers, quote, off the deep end last week. To be fair, if they're viewing us, they are off the deep end. And what you are about to read may be a testament to that. Almost 2 years ago was RFN's 400th episode. This was also a point in my life where I thought it would be a good idea to send a ridiculous amount of money to have James Jones send me a game of his choosing based on my gaming tastes. He sent a nice personal letter about why he decided to send me the game he did, and it was very fun to read and keep as a constant reminder of the mistake that I had made by sending money to a monster. The game he sent me was Adean Chronicles for the Nintendo 64. Upon receiving this," the sneer quotes are very important here, "game, I was pretty excited to try it out and report back what I was already expecting to be a pretty awful game. Now, normally, if I don't like a game, I will just stop playing it. No harm done. However, the personal problem that I had with quitting this time was the realization that this was technically the most expensive game I had ever purchased. I spent triple digits on this trash heap, and I'll be damned if I wasn't going to see it through. So I finally mustered up the courage to actually give this thing a real shot a couple months ago, and after turning the brightness on to max on my TV, I was ready to really dive into this thing and pick away at it little by little. However, a couple weeks ago, I reached my breaking point. To keep it brief, there's a point in the game where you go to an island, and when you get there, you can't go back until you finish that area. Well, my party's severely underleveled from trying to avoid the god-awful combat, and the encounters that I have to finish in this area are way too hard for me to beat. So I'm stuck. The guide I read online even says to create a second save file before entering this area. Fuck off, Adean Chronicles. Fuck off. In all seriousness, I love the show. Keep up the fantastic works. I send my regards from the blackest pit of the only Nintendo 64 RPG worse than Quest 64. Yep, that all checks out. To be fair, the Kusa Game Master thing was not my idea. I was asked, and I delivered. I did the extra mile, though. I actually still have all the letters I sent to people, and they were personalized for the game. It took way too much work, and also I made us play these games, so the only one we couldn't play was the Dragon Ball PSP game, because none of us are monsters.
Yeah, well, I'm a monster, but I have the a PSP Go, so
you're a different kind of monster.
Yeah, perhaps even worse. An even worse monster. All I can say to Kane is that, yes, Adean Chronicles is terrible from the little I've played during the recording of the 400th episode. But also, look up sunk cost fallacy and try to avoid it, because you just went straight into a giant, giant pit of that thing.
Yeah.
And there's no obligation for you.
It's already gone. Let it go.
Yeah. Yeah, the money is lost. I love Adean Chronicles just because it's something I can make fun of. It's a consistent punchline that never, ever runs out of steam. But, with that said, it is time for new business. And I'm going to lead off this week because I picked a game with the intention of it being appropriate for... Little voice pop there I was anticipating. Being appropriate for the 10th anniversary. So What I picked, what this is being tentatively called the first Too Hot for Games 2. Moero Neketsu Rhythm Damashi Osu Take Ondan 2. This is actually a game I bought for the summer of No Games and moved it up because it actually is... Well, they were talking about the Elite Beat Agents in the first couple episodes of...
That's right,
Ready for
Nintendo. The second episode is called Elite Unbeatable Agents because...
Right.
Evan was mesmerized by Johnny and Windy playing EBA, or playing a Wendan, I guess. They probably were playing a Wendan, you know, their copies of a Wendan, which was already out in Japan, and everybody imported it because it was a lot of fun. And then EBA was about to come out, you know, at that show.
So I've played the original. Oh, this is the Innes-developed rhythm game that is one of the most Japanese games I've played in a while, which is saying a lot. Like, that's a high bar. The first, as Greg said, the first EBA was one of those early DS games where you really went, oh, not EBA, the first Ondan was one of those where you said, oh, wow, this is kind of, like, different. Like, you can really do stuff with the DS that you couldn't do before. What the game has you do, because, I mean, these games are 10 years old. You could totally be listening to this show, and I've never seen these games before. Basically, you get pop music blasted at you with completely asinine comic book story presented, and you have to essentially tap out the rhythm of these things in these little dots that show up, and occasionally there's sliders and there's like wheels you have to spin and stuff like that essentially power this group of male cheerleaders who cheer on people struggling from real life problems or not so real life problems. You're based on how close you are to hitting the note, the beat exactly, and of course making sure you actually hit all the beats when you're supposed to and don't miss anything, and things like the sliders where you roll along with the thing as it moves and all that kind of stuff. And these are really, really cool games, and it's been a very, very long time since one of these got made. And in fact, Keiichi Yano did an interview recently, he's the designer of these games, saying that he would really like to do another one. It's basically going to be based on whatever NX is. But, of course, these are Nintendo published, which means they own the series, so they can't just go somewhere else and make them. The first Ondan was kind of a revelation because it was so weird and crazy. And as Greg pointed out, it was one of those, like, first DS games that was broadly imported.
Yeah, it was like that, and the Jump Superstars or whatever, the fighting game, was another really popular import around then.
I would assume is what essentially encouraged Nintendo to go ahead and tell Innes to make one explicitly for Western markets, Elite Beat Agents. It's kind of weird that as opposed to localizing the one that existed, they just made a whole new game.
Yeah, but because the songs were different; they were a lot more sort of mainstream Western pop kind of stuff, and then they changed the character somewhat to the whole kind of Men in Black style agents.
It's
not like with other rhythm games. Again, it's like we talked about Donkey Kongers, like to some extent they're quite different between
right,
the regions, even though they might still be called as Donkey Konga 2, because they feel like they have to kind of accommodate the musical taste of the region they go into, and they can end up being pretty different just because of that.
Right, and mostly like Japanese music games don't get localized that often. Like before Elite Beat Agent, like the DDR games, I guess, have Japanese music in them, and they're pretty popular.
A lot of them.
But it's not like the like those drum games ever made it here, right? Like
occasionally they would, but yeah, the majority of them didn't.
Right. So I can understand from that, you know, from that standpoint, like why Nintendo would just be like, yeah, let's make a new one. Let's not just try to sell this to the global audience.
It's not just that they made a new one. It's that they went or changed the music. It's that they went and made a whole new, like, everything. You know, they made new characters. They made new, like, stories. And some of it was de-Japanifying some of the plot or some of the individual little stories. And some of it was just because I assume that the music and the stuff going on screen are so kind of linked to the rhythm that you'd almost have to remake everything. Because, like, even if you just had to change the timings of stuff showing up on screen and finding music that would fit which the art existing art assets. I guess they just said it was an opportunity to kind of make this game more broadly appealing outside of Japan, because they did market this under their Touch Generations banner, which was their attempt to kind of like be more broad reaching on the DS, but in that era before people had smartphones.
And they kind of did that later on when they localized Rhythm Heaven for DS, didn't they?
Yep.
They did the same thing. That's different again, really. But in that case, you know, they were just localizing the game. It wasn't like a totally, you know, the music was fundamentally the same. Obviously, they had to change lyrics and stuff like that. But yeah, that was just more of a straight localization.
The thing about it that I was, you know, as I was going through it today, because I've played the first game and I've played Elite Beat Agents, I guess licensing all the music outside of Japan would have also been kind of a nightmare. So I can see just going like, all right, just screw it. Let's just do a new one. But what's weird is in Japan, so Elite Beat Agents has a bunch of like gameplay tweaks that, you know, were improvements on the first Oendon. In Japan, they didn't release Elite Beat Agents. They went and made a sequel to Oendon with Oendon 2. So there's this weird, like, there's two games in Japan that the West never got, and one game in the West that Japan never got. And, you know, Never the Twain Shall Meet, which is kind of a crazy thing to think about. They made three of these things, and no market has more than two. But they just sort of stopped after the second one. What's different about the second one is it's got local multiplayer, which I can't remember if EBA had. I know the first Oendon doesn't. But primarily, it's just a slightly better game in a lot of ways. And I was kind of surprised at how quick I picked this thing up. I haven't played one of these games in, I don't know, 6 years at the most recent, like it's been a long time, and they're just so immediately approachable. Now they get very hard very fast.
But
there's something about them that just works, and you know they are really 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 good at representing the music in what you're doing on screen, and not just all the rhythms are right. You know, you may have an arpeggio going up in the song, and what you'll find is the dots you need to hit are going up. There'll be like a little flourish in the song, and they kind of wrap, the dots end up wrapping around themselves, which is actually really hard because you have to kind of trace where they go. And if it's fast, that can be really difficult to say, is this the next one I hit or is that the next one I hit? Like, it does a really nice job representing the music in gameplay. So as you play the game, you may not feel like you're memorizing the note patterns, and you may be but you find yourself getting better anyway. And the reason is your brain is getting used to the song. And it's sort of like subconsciously adapting where your eyes are going for the next beat. And
you're anticipating, perhaps not even very consciously, but you're anticipating where everything's going to start showing up without it being like just total. That's the great thing about it being set to music. You know, I mean, if you just had to somehow recreate that pattern, you'd have no chance whatsoever. But on an intuitive basis, like you said, because the way they construct those patterns is very intuitive, you just find yourself kind of meshing with it, and soon enough, it doesn't seem so ridiculously hard anymore.
And like playing music, it's a lot of note phrases. So there'll be a phrase in that shows up, and it keeps coming up in the song because musicians are lazy and they'll reuse phrases all the time. Musicians would say the human brain likes that, but there's laziness in it.
Symmetry, payoff, you know, that kind of thing.
I once had a song that repeated 36 times a series of measures. Musicians can be lazy. But the thing is, like, because you learn it, when you get deeper in the song, if you re-encounter this stuff, it just gives you opportunity to sort of get back. Because the game has this kind of constantly ticking down health meter, and you refill it by hitting notes. Missing notes costs you, but it's always going down. So when the game's kind of in this weird idle state where there won't be any notes on the screen, you're still losing health. It's kind of a gauntlet thing where you have to keep feeding them even though you're not doing anything wrong. And what happens is you learn these note patterns. Those become essentially like boss room, like the pre-boss health fountains. Where like I'm going to heal up before I go to this next crazy thing the game's about to throw at me. And what I found with this game, it's almost completely intelligible with only a really limited Japanese understanding.
Yeah, oh yeah, I played the second one. I didn't play the first one, but I played the second Oendon, and I without a lick of Japanese comprehension, and I was perfectly fine with it.
But understanding the stories, because they're mostly intelligible. You know, there's the first one is there's a businessman who's trying to get over, and you know, he's dealing with things like he lives in his family's house and they're loud, and it ends with him being shipped all the way to America because of his great business idea. Or, you know, the slightly more childish of, like, you know, you're playing in a kid's dream because his mother chastised him for wetting the bed, and he's trying to not wet the bed this night. And so he's dreaming of things like leaking pipes where two very kind of conspicuous-looking plumbers are fixing them, a dam bursting, and other such water-related phenomena. And you're cheering him on, and essentially you're causing other phantoms to show up in his dream and stop the flow of water. to the very Japanese of helping a sumo wrestler get better, to the kind of like depressing of this figure skater who essentially ceded to her best friend who is going to, I guess, compete in the big tournament, who ultimately gets hit by a fucking car in the intro and dies, and you have to take over her. She has to put the skates back on after years and take her spot and win, and you're encouraging that.
Yeah, there's always a somber one, I think. I mean, like, I assume there's one of the first to end on, but in the second one, it's like about the dad dies,
yeah,
and it's about the wife and the kid like trying to get
elite
over
agent.
In yeah. elite yeah. agents. Yeah, and like, the best part of that is when you mess up a sequence, because it's kind of like
it's so bad.
There's like little checkpoints, isn't there? So it's kind of like, well, you know, if you're under a certain level on that meter that you talked about. At a certain point of the song, you've kind of flunked that section, and the actual story reflects that. So, like with the dad, instead of there being like some heartwarming picture of, you know, when they were all together at that point, there's just like a picture of him kind of admiring himself, like he's some sort of weird narcissist. So, that's like my, probably, other than the Jumpin' Jack Flash finale, that's probably my abiding memory of EBA.
Oh, my favorite one of these. So the little story here is that this European-looking group of Owen Don showed up, and they have this weird kind of like passive rivalry with the first group. Like they'll do like scenes of them passing each other in the street and kind of eyeballing each other. Which is weird that these cheerleading groups have this kind of like street turf mentality. There's one where like the original group is walking by and they see the leader of the other group bent over holding an umbrella, and they look kind of like that jerk. And then they see he's like sheltering a kitten in a box. It's like, what is happening right now? This is so stupid. But my ultimate story, like my favorite one of his little plot segments, is there's a construction worker who's talking to his girlfriend, and it turns out he's actually a werewolf, and anytime he sees something that reminds him of the moon, like his boss's bald head, her earrings, anything round and roughly white, he starts transforming, and you spend the entire like sequence encouraging him to keep his transformation under control and covering up whatever it is that was going to push him over the edge. And when you succeed, you fail, he transforms, and it turns out she's actually a furry, and she's all over it. It's like, wow, this game is stupid as hell. I'm so pleased with everything about this. It's got this kind of like crazy, ridiculous mentality that I think the music in this game suits better than Elite Beat Agents. Elite Beat Agents, I think, was trying to go for a more broad appeal. So you had a lot of music from, you know, previous generation stuff showing up. I mean, you mentioned Jumpin' Jack Flash. Like that one kind of works, but there was a lot of like soapy ballad stuff in there, and kind of stuff that, you know, from the 70s and sometimes even earlier, disco and things popped up. This
and
game
not,
is...
not that the contemporary stuff was any better, because it starts with Skater Boy, right?
Yeah, it does. But it feels very much like they were trying to kind of check off boxes of appeal. Owen Don 2 is very, very kind of youth energy in all the music. You know, you get a lot of like weird rock rap stuff. There's not a ton of rock in Elite Beat Agents. You get a bunch of hip hop. You get this kind of weird funk music that shows up a couple times. Like there's a much more of kind of like a just an energy to this stuff. You know, this kind of like youthful verve that carries along with it. So it's kind of fun that way, and I think it matches the gameplay a little bit better. And they have a lot of them have really driving beats that I think some of the Elite Beat Agents music didn't have. Like they were just trying to fit the song in, whereas pretty much every song in this game has a really hard driving beat that makes the game a bit easier. And of course, I'm playing this on the XL, which is the first time I played one of these on the XL, and it makes a difference.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it would. Yeah, that's a big thing, having that. Because, I mean, that's actually one of the things that happens on the harder difficulty, is the circles get smaller. So,
yes.
You know, actually just making them bigger on the screen, with a bigger screen, it surely must help a fair bit.
Well, the downside is, so one of the things I picked up in this game, I don't know why I never picked it up, is that the distance between the dots, if they're stretched out, represents the fact there's a rest there. Like, there's actually a beat pattern rest. So if they're long, that's a visual indicator to you, besides a little collapsing ring, that you need to take a breath and not try to drive through this note. Because to me, the biggest problem I have is I jump the gun on a note. And when they chain a bunch of notes together, you don't have time to adjust. So you just magnify your failure a bunch of times.
Yes, that's true. You're just off consistently, kind of, aren't you?
Until the next break, essentially, and you could reset. So essentially, like, almost the hardest thing to do in this game isn't do perfect. So, like, I'm stuck on the last level right now, the Jumpin' Jack Flash equivalent. In this case, the sun has died and everyone is freezing. I like the fail state, which is the cheerleaders with this, like, really gleeful look, like they're just taking a walk. Frozen in ice.
The end of The Shining, but with male cheerleaders.
It's very weird, but the there's this chain of like 13 notes at one point, and that has killed me every time, because there's a big, it's like a double pause. Like, you really have to wait for it, and I'm always jumping the gun, and once I do, I can't stop it.
Yeah, right. So yeah, you're cooked basically at that point. You know.
So it's like I actually got to that stage and had not screwed up yet. That's like 300 notes in and lost.
And yeah, like, so again, that's the thing with that health, the way the health meters kind of works, that is a lot of the time how you're going to fail, is just like one hardcore crater like that. You know, it can be pretty. I can remember some of those EBA songs in particular just ended up getting... undesirably emblazoned on my memory, just because it was so fun. I really wanted to get it done, but at the same time, it's like, if I hear this again, I'm gonna kill myself.
Oh yeah, I've got one from this game that's there. A Jumpin' Jack Flash made me nuts, because that is properly difficult stage.
It's tough.
It's long.
It's tough. Oh yeah. Again, that'll be emblazoned in my head forever, I think, that one. But
yeah, and it's such a bad version of that song too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Cause that's it. They're all like, you know, faux. They're all sound alike stuff. Like,
right.
Yeah, so that was, you know, that wasn't one of the closer ones.
There's the track list for Owendon 2. There's 16 songs on it. Only one song has the original artist, which is actually above the other games in the series. So that tells you kind of what you're dealing with here. Instead, you get like the house band version of some of these songs. And some of them I've heard before, like they're kind of the sort of like J-pop stuff that sort of crossed over and you hear it in some places. Or maybe it's a song that was tied to a TV show. And like, I always felt like, oh, I get into these really fast because I kind of know this song. But the music in this game is really cool. Like, I kind of really just dig the energy it has, and I'm happy playing it, and I'm enjoying the stupidity of the story, and the gameplay is just really fun. And I realized when I sat down to play this last night, I was like, all right, I'm going to play it for like half an hour. I'm going to go finish off Bravely Second, and then I'm going to go to bed. I played it all the way to the last song in a sitting. Like, I just cranked that game out. And I thought, oh God, this is, I've gone too far at this point. And you just have to put it down at some point, because you'll get to a song where you're just toast and you just can't get through it. And it's just mental. And that was essentially what happened. I was like, I can't break through this barrier. So I just got to stop now. But like, God, I hope, you know, that interview just coincidentally happened a couple days ago. God, I hope Innes makes another one of these. Nintendo, please, please, like, make this happen. This is such a cool thing that, it probably doesn't make money, I get it. But God, is it fun. Anyway,
I'd love to see it come back. I really enjoyed the two I played, and it's been a while now. I mean, I picked up the Owendon 2 quite a while after it had originally come out, not as long as yourself, obviously.
Yeah.
But it probably has been about 6 years at a minimum, I would venture.
It's so cool. They're so cool, and Hopefully NX can do that, but again, standard caveat of we have no idea what NX is. Anyway, Guillaume.
Yes.
What have you been playing?
Yeah, so, you know, two episodes ago I talked about the Pocket Card Jockey demo, and the game is finally out, has been for a week now. And I've been playing that, and it's just freaking addictive in a very good way. Although I did kind of go to bed at like 2 in the morning on a weekday, and that was unadvisable. It was a bad, sad life decision that I regret. But other than that, like I'm really pleased with the game, and it's still, you know, like I am getting a better grasp of the different things that come into play than before, because you know, with the demo, I was just trying to play the solitaire game to the best of my ability. And sometimes I got unlucky, it seemed, and sometimes I got lucky, and I, you know, like it seemed that there was a lot of chance in whether I was going to win a race or not. And now I understand better, like the things that I have to look out for, like the temperament of your horse actually comes into play. You know, there's an icon representing how fast they're going to lose their temper, and so when in that case, it might be better to, instead of aiming for like the sweet spot that the game shows you, the sweet spot to race where the horse is going to gain a lot of bonuses, like a lot of motivation and stuff like that, of energy, it might be wise to place him outside of that zone, because then the solitaire games becomes easier to play. There are fewer cards on the tableau, as it's called, so fewer cards to get rid of on the field, and it just might, you know, be the better choice at that point, because otherwise, like, if you don't finish your solitaire game when your horse is in the sweet spot, he's just going to completely go berserk and run away and lose all his stamina, and you're kind of, you know, you're done, basically. So it's pretty fun. Like there's some elements, like I'm enjoying the breeding aspect of it. Basically you try to improve your horse as much as you can during the growth phase. And when the horse reaches the age of 4, then you try to win as many trophies as you can, because the more wins you get, the better the offspring is going to be. And then you try to match the horse with a partner that's compatible or something. That, I still don't know what that looks like. I just pair my best horses together. But apparently there might be like icons that pop up when two horses would be like, you know, ideal parents or something. So the offsprings really are better than the parents. Like one horse, like usually when you gain a level in the growth mode for a regular horse, you gain maybe 6, 7, or 8 points for your stamina or your, I forget the other metric, energy, maybe? Anyway, speed. So that's about how much you get, but with one of the offsprings, like she gained like 22 in one level. And then that calmed down with further, you know, the next levels, but still, like it was quite a big jump, and so it pays to kind of to try the breeding aspect of it. I'm not so much a fan of the writing anymore. Like there's the game is very goofy, you know. Like I described the premise that basically you die and an angel allows you to play solitaire to win that horse racing to win the Derby. Like it's very goofy, but there's one element. So you know, like Karen had started the demo, and she had picked the female trainer, and the game tells you at the beginning, you know, like the gender of your trainer, of your jockey rather, is not, you know, is not going to have a consequence on gameplay, but it does have a consequence on some of the dialogue, because at some point the angel says, like, I'm going to help you realize, like, you have to promise me that you're going to realize your dream, and the character, the girl responds, well, that's fine. My dream is to get married and have babies. So, and you know, like it's a joke, you know, your dream is supposed to be winning the Derby. But anyway, she wants to pump out babies. And when it's the boy, he wants to take over his like granddad's orange farm. So there's some weird like gender role stuff going on, and the game actually, like, you're racing the horses of the horses that have owners, and one of the owners is this kind of diva, kind of celebrity kind of thing, like very, stereotypically vapid, kind of like she's
Nouveau
at,
riche.
like the girls in the Material Girl song from EBA, to keep it relevant to our previous
There we go.
discussion.
Sure. Right. So like she's basically a, I don't know, Kim Kardashian. I don't really know. But anyway, like she's meant to be kind of superficial and stuff like that. Except that one, like when the guy who helps you in the game tells you like her accomplishments, he also says that she's a history buff, and like, huh, that's funny. Also, that kind of redeems her character a little bit, right? But then the game opens, has like this kind of thing. It reminds me of We Catch, where the better you did at this kind of very simple, baseball catching game, the more story you would discover or uncover. And so the more you win in this game, the more you race the horses of each owner, the more you learn about them. And she basically, the reason why she's a history buff is that it's very en vogue right now. It's like the thing to be a geek. And so it's also to boost like her popularity. Basically, she's an actual history buff, I guess, like she but she's a fake history buff. So maybe at some point there will be something in her story arc that will redeem her, but right now, yeah, I'm not
Is
enjoying the story that much.
it just too much? I know you said the beginning was very, and I played the demo and I'd agree it was pretty talkative. Is it, does it, is it to the detriment of the game just in general that it's talkative even as it keeps going?
No, the following scenes are shorter. I mean, there's the one place where the game is too talkative and doesn't let you skip, because the full game, okay, so in the demo you touch the screen once to kind of make the to start the next part of the dialogue, like you press A to continue, right? And you can't make the text appear faster. In the full game you can, which is fantastic. Except there's one the when there's this horse that gives you, like, that tells you why you failed to win a certain race. Like, he gives you tips at the end of each race. And he won't, you can't skip ahead his dialogue. And he always says the same thing. So that's the one thing, like,
Great.
once he starts saying, "Your horse was low in energy," you know what he's going to say next. Like, you know the tips he's going to give you. So you don't really need to see them, but
Steroids.
yeah. So either you skip the whole thing by pressing X and you don't see like the following tips, or you just have to mash A through them and wait until he's done. So that's the one sticking point. But otherwise, like the dialogue kind of gets out of the way for the most part. You spend most of your time actually playing solitaire and positioning your horse and stuff like that. Then I'm hooked, and as I said, it's already led me to lose some sleep, but yeah, it's fun.
Everyone knows that the best part of horse racing is silly names. Have you got any
Oh,
silly
it
na-
in a lot of ways.
have you got any silly names for us? It reminds me of when I was playing Infinite Space, which is very much like a solitaire horse game in many ways. And I just my just the, my favorite part of that was naming my ship stupid stuff. What? Give us some of your best.
Oh God, I don't feel too
Too
good about
blue
some of the names.
it's
for the
No, but it's just like a
She's
I want
the
to know.
fastest, followed by always comes in second, and I'm number three in third.
I want to know how long you can make them, because I love it when you see ridiculously long horse names. If I
Right,
was going to
well.
name a horse in this, it would be Stannis Baratheon's ill-fated playoff beard, but that's probably wouldn't
I don't think
fit.
that fits, no.
So
But
that
I've
actually
got.
gets worse in dog names because you can never reuse a name, so they end up with ridiculous garbage like that.
So one of my first mares was Lazy Harris. I don't know.
Nice.
There was this kind of red-haired horse I called Spicy Peanut. Very cute. There's this guy with this toupee and like very nerdy looking, and he's got a bow tie. And I called him Flying Toupee, but then Karen was like, "Oh, we should have called him Bow Ties Are Cool," in reference to Matt Smith, Doctor Who. And I was like, "Fucking damn it! It's perfect." But she's gonna have him in her game, so it's I can't really use that. There's this horse with a pompadour.
Yeah.
Right. So he's Pompadours, of course. And yeah, just stuff like that. The one that I miss, yeah, there's like this ninja character. I called her Silent and Deadly, but yeah, I don't know. At some point, I fancied myself a Cards Against Humanity card writer, and I called one Ableist Language, but I kind of immediately regretted it. So I, yeah. Anyway, I'm sure people will find much better stuff to call their horses than I...
I'm interested what you called your horses. I strongly encourage John Lindemann's deportation papers. send us your horse list, because I'm deathly curious about how badly this is going to go. Because as Greg points out, I started naming all my ships in Infinite Space as species of whale, of toothed whale specifically, and then got bored and just started naming them awful things. As I sent them off to the grinder to get crushed as the shield of my fleet.
Okay, mm-hmm. You want to make an omelette, you gotta break some eggs.
That's right.
So the last game that I've been playing is the Pinball Arcade, which finally came out on the Wii U.
Yeah.
And so unfortunately, because it's such a late release, I think a lot of the people I would have as, well, a lot of friends have bought it on other platforms. Yeah, the good news is there's no friend-specific leaderboards, so it doesn't really matter.
He could pretend that they perfect. Did buy this version.
Yeah, but I guess maybe there's no friend-specific leaderboards on any platform, because I guess, you know, this is available on, you know, iOS and Android and PC and every console now. So maybe it would have been too complicated to try to keep some sort, or it didn't make sense to try to keep a friend's specific leaderboard for each of them.
Yeah,
I've got
a few tables on the 360. I've got a few tables on the Xbox One, and I honestly, because I haven't got many Xbox friends anyway, I don't think I've ever checked that. But
right,
you know,
well, I checked before recording just to be able to say if it has it or not, because I know some people want to know, right? But you do get regular leaderboards. You know, I'm pretty sure they must be across every platform, so that's cool. Wii U owners can compete with Xbox owners. And
no, I mean, I think when this does come to Europe, because it hasn't yet, as is typical with the Farsight developed pinball stuff over the years, it's usually lagged behind in Europe a fair bit. But it is coming, because it was in the last, sort of European... video about downloadable games coming out. I'll probably get some more tables, because the one thing is, it's great on Xbox. I love pinball, but you know, off TV play would make it so much more viable as a time sink for me.
Right.
I mean, like stuff like Pokemon Pinball on GBA, I put quite a lot of time in. I had Star Wars Pinball. Put a lot of time into that on Wii U. It's a great pinball playing machine, so I'm very much looking forward to this.
Nice. Yeah, I've been mostly playing on the TV, but yeah, for sure, it's a good thing to have. And like by default, it's what's it called again? Mirroring the screen on the gamepad. So yeah, you get the table Tales of the Arabian Nights for free when you download the game, and it's quite a good table, actually.
No, it's really good. I mean, that is I think the thing with that is why they probably chose that is because it, like the precursor to the Pinball Arcade, which is a digital thing, was the Williams collection that they did, which was so they did that as like a disc release. I reviewed the Wii version of that many years ago.
Famous, the Williams collection.
Yeah, and then latterly it came out on PS3, 360. So I guess it's just like those tables were kind of old hat. You know, like they get thrown in as the bonus tables in the first season
where it's kind of like one new table, one old table, and so I guess the demo table was bound to be one of those. But those tables are generally really good, you know, and that one is probably one of the better ones from I remember of it.
Yeah, and I actually bought the Williams collection back in the day, and I don't think that table stood out for me just because there were, you know, there was a dozen tables.
There was a lot, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so
maybe
I just
got to 15 on some versions, I forget.
Yeah, so having it free, like the first and only table that you have when you download the game, like that allows it to shine a little bit. Like I spent more time on it than before, and yeah, like it's really well made and really cool. One of the first the first table that I bought was the Addams Family table, and I've heard so much about that one.
It's very famous because I think it's listed as the highest selling pinball machine ever, you know, like it shipped the most tables ever.
I've seen dozens of individual units of that in the wild. So
it's quite famous, and I think it's well thought of as a table, but I think it's disproportionately famous because of how ubiquitous it was, relatively speaking.
Yeah, so I guess I must have heard of its popularity, and I must have switched that in my brain, like, oh, it's like it's considered one of the best tables ever. And I was a little bit disappointed with it. So I spent quite a bit of time on it, but I don't know. It just doesn't feel that great, and
Medieval Madness is your best pinball table ever.
I like Medieval Madness. That was on the Williams collection.
Oh yeah, absolutely, it would be. It's amazing.
That's great fun. I mean, like I say, it's got to click with you though. I can't really account for why certain tables click and why they don't. You know, why I get. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's like a table didn't click with me, and then I come back to it however many months later and just think, ah, screw it, I'll have a go. And you have one particularly good go where you kind of, you know, understand all the different, like, you know, tasks and stuff a bit better or something, and get some of the shots down, and then it does click with you all of a sudden. It's kind of, it's hard to kind of define it, but I mean, one of my favorites that was not a Williams one is Theater of Magic. That's really good. Well worth looking into.
Yes.
Okay. James likes Theater of Magic.
Oh no, we're gonna get back into pinball stuff. So yeah, we've gone down this road before.
Well, I just want to say the other table that I bought so far is Star Trek Next Generation. Mostly
I've got that one.
That's a good table too.
Yeah. I mostly because you know, Karen watched the show when she was a teenager. I didn't. It was not really playing on my French Canadian channels. So
even though the primary character is called Jean-Luc, I mean, that's
absolutely.
Surely
yeah.
It was just, you know, made to be a huge smash over there.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Well, I'll ask after you're done.
Yeah. So I've only got a. You know, I'm familiar with the Star Trek Next Generation movies, and I watch maybe the first three seasons on Netflix, and I don't think the show has aged particularly well. After
yeah,
the first three seasons, I watched maybe some of the best, you know, the considered best episodes, and I was done.
I haven't seen that for ages, Next Generation, but...
It's hokey in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Absolutely, but the table is fun, and the sound samples are really, you know, clear, and there's a lot of personality to the table. You know, like you'll have Data starting to say something, and Jean-Luc just cutting him off, you know, annoyed, or you know, like cute stuff like that. There's
Shove
one
it,
thing
robot
though,
boy.
Like if you take it as like a representation of, I don't know, like if you try to transpose your pinball adventures to what it would like in a show, it would be really, really weird, because at some point I was shooting asteroids that were in our way, and while I was doing that, I got promoted to commander. And I'm just like, really? Was I really kissing ass?
That is how you climb the greasy pole.
I guess, but
you
like...
You can shoot those asteroids.
Is when you're in the middle of a dangerous asteroid field, is that really the time to be like kissing ass and trying to climb the ladder? I don't know. So yeah, it's iffy in that way, but otherwise it's a great table.
Yeah, I like
how
it.
How good are these visually represented? Because I have one enduring memory of how this table looks, and it's Commander Reichert's hair.
Really?
Because it's really badly drawn. Riker's hair looks terrible. And, like, I wonder, like, how well did they capture all, like, the art on these tables and really make them... Like, are they all, like, actual image captures, or they try to reproduce
them?
Yeah,
I mean, I would say it was really impressive on Wii how good the artwork looked on those tables, like Gorgar and all that stuff. Like, they look surprisingly high quality when you think Wii was a standard definition console. But now that, you know, in the HD era, tables are played, they look really good. Although, kind of, I mean, with Xbox One, I mean, you could change the lighting, but, like, the default is that it's a bit darker to kind of make it feel a bit more... Like, with Wii, it was very bright. So maybe you could kind of... It was nice in a way because you'd actually see the good reproduction of the artwork, but it didn't feel like playing in an arcade. It would never be that well lit. So you've kind of got other options to make it look more natural, but then you're probably not going to quite see every aspect of the artwork. But, I mean, these are pretty meticulous reproductions, you know, to the point where the actual... Like the actual sort of software, the pinball table itself is being emulated rather than just having it sort of be scripted. They actually have the actual original kind of software that the pinball tables were running is being emulated to produce that table. That's the kind of lengths that they go to with these. It's really top notch stuff.
Yeah, like all the art is there and it's pretty nice, and you can go on pinballarcade.com and see, like, you can see screenshots, or you can see screenshots of the tables, each of them, and it's well done, except that sometimes, you know, like, you look a little bit more closely and some elements of the tables look blocky, you know, kind of low poly. And that's a little bit jarring. Like, if you look at the Star Trek Next Generation table, there's these launchers, and they're right up, like, next to the flippers. So they're very close to you, and they look like a bunch of rectangles, like in boxes, you know? So
that's weird.
Yeah. And I thought, like, oh, maybe it's the Wii U version. Maybe somehow they had to sacrifice a few polygons for it. But no, it's, like, it's their official screenshots are like that, too. So...
Maybe it's something with the technology they use for making the scans or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's not, you know, it's not a deal breaker for me. It's not, and it's not a constant, like, annoyance or whatever, eyesore. Like, mostly you're playing pinball, you're paying attention to the ball, and you're trying to stay in the game. So,
fair enough. I wanna say that now I'm on Pinside, which is a website that categorizes pinball tables, and I'm mortified to find that they still make pinball tables of every major TV show or movie out there, despite the fact I have no idea where you can play them.
Yeah.
So, in 2015, they released a Game of Thrones based on the TV series Pinball Table, with Rory McCann actually giving you, like, guided tips through the actual game. What?
Wonderful.
Where would you even play? God.
Well, there's still pinball tables at, like, movie theaters, and
there's
a few places.
Like, I love pinball, and I would never, ever, 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 ever say, you know what, Game of Thrones table, you got me. So, Stern, of course it's Stern. Stern, good on you. Greg.
Yep. Well, I've got something DS and retro for the 10th anniversary. It's a little too old, believe it or not. My choice.
Well, it's
you went
fine.
Too far back in time.
Actually, then they could have been playing it on the show, so you're fine.
It's actually from the summer of 2005, this one, but it's another import DS game. This is Gunbury Goemon for DS. The full title is polysyllabic, to say the least. And I'm not even going to attempt it. It's something to do with Tengu and touching. And, yeah, it's it's a mouthful. It certainly puts Sharp FE into perspective.
Hold on, I'm going to give it a shot. Ganbare Goemon, Sawaratade... Oh, my God! Jesus! Sawaratade... There, oh geez, is this the right game?
I'm not sure
this is
the
Game Boy game.
Good.
I get to bail out. That's hard. That's a really hard game to pronounce.
There's loads of Goemon games.
Oh, here we go. Ganbare Goemon Tokai Dochu Oedo Tengu Ri Kaeshi no Maki. Wow.
There
That's
you go.
A lot of fucking name. That's what That's I a lot of name.
I warned you. But yeah, so this is the Goemon game for DS, and essentially the end of the Goemon series. It has shown up in patchy slot form since.
But so you mean the start of the Goemon series?
Yeah, you know that where Konami characters very much went to die about 4 or 5 years ago. It was the patchy slot adaptations, but you know, Goemon, which had been a very prolific series for quite a number of years, up to, you know, for about 20 years. I think the first Goemon game, Mr. Goemon, came out in about 86 in the arcades, and then this was 2005. So they had a good, you know, 20-year run of games, and you know, came out a fair clip across a bunch of different formats. But this was basically the end. And I'd been trying to get this for a long time. You know, I kind of got into Goemon on Virtual Console, on the Japanese Virtual Console, after I kind of missed it in the Super Famicom import scene. Like, we read reviews when it was new, the original one that was localized as Mystical Ninja came out in Super Famicom, but it sounded cool, it looked cool in screenshots and stuff. We're big Konami fans, so that was a draw, but there's the whole text barrier stuff, you know, in the pre-internet era just kind of frightened us off. So, you know, I had a near miss with Goemon as a little kid, came back to it on Virtual Console, fell in love with it, and started charting amongst this myriad of Goemon games that there are, which ones did I want to get? Because, you know, you kind of knew that not that many more of them were going to be showing up on digital services or whatever. So I started getting them. I've talked about a number of them on the show and I was on before. And this is basically, you know, appropriately enough, the last one on my list. This was it. And I've got it on eBay a couple of weeks ago. Finished playing it tonight. So this is, yeah, this is kind of the death of Goemon for me personally, even though it's like 11 years after he died. It's you know, like one of those embarrassing Twitter situations where someone finds out that someone was dead even though he's been dead for 2 years or whatever. That's how I'm looking at it. It's still, if it's emotional for me, is the point.
Well, so I will say that Goemon, Gambare Goemon, Go for it Goemon, yes. Goemon is actually based on a real person.
Yeah, the sort of the Robin Hood folk tale-y kind of thing.
Yeah, Goemon, know. Ishikawa, he was a thief during the feudal war era. Who stole from the rich and gave to the poor. He actually was killed more mercilessly than Gambare Goemon. He and his son were boiled alive after attempting to assassinate Hideyoshi. So,
nice.
Konami got the idea from history.
Yeah, so that's the thing. I mean, this is wacky Konami. That's the thing. I mean, I love wacky Konami.
And it's the best.
You know, they were so
crazy
wonderful.
Racers.
Yeah, Crazy Racers, you know, Paradius, you know, they used to just have like these whole sub-series sort of spin-offs, you know, Kid Dracula.
Metal Gear Solid.
You know, that were just based around being goofy and wacky and all that, and Goemon was very much that. And I guess the funny thing is, like I said, they'd had some, you know, plenty of games come out in the sort of the Famicom generation, then, you know, a lot of games on Super Famicom. Then sort of it gets split in the next generation because you had two on N64, but then you had a few on PlayStation. But, you know, still, and then Game Boy and all this, you know, so it was all over the place. And then I guess it kind of ran into trouble around about the turn of the century. They started trying to do, like, reboots and stuff. Like, there's the PS2 games, very early PS2 games, kind of infamously bad, that tried to have a less whimsical, less goofy kind of tone to it. Working Designs famously like tried to localize it and failed because it's a terrible game apparently, and Sony were not in favor of having it get out of Japan. But then there was also, in addition to that, there was this sort of I think it was sort of like Goemon New Age or something. They tried to sort of give him a sci-fi anime makeover. So that he was more of his spiky blue hair became the other kind of spiky blue hair that you associate with anime characters.
The action-y kind, yeah.
Yeah, and like Ibisumaru became a cute little girl instead of a fat guy, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, they went through all these kinds of sort of attempts to try and make it more popular. And then this game for DS actually, because, you know,
screw all that. We're just going to go back to pretty much plain old Goemon. And, you know, they have the old character designs back. And this time it's presented in an aesthetic that's a nice kind of watercolor, kind of look, you know, a bit reminiscent of Okami that was, well, hadn't come out at the time that this game was released. But I assume it had been shown or whatever. But, you know, it's got a really gorgeous kind of hand painted look to it, but with the same kind of goofy school of character design that you had before. And there is, even though, of course, it being in Japanese, you can't get a lot of the gags or whatever that I'm sure are in the game. There is a gag that I did get where you actually see the Goemon redesign sort of locked up in prison, having been beaten up. Just all really sad. I know, that was great. It was kind of like, yeah, you know, it's just reeked of like, yeah, we're glad that's over. You know, let's get on with Goemon proper. And of course, this was the last game.
I'm looking at it. I'm looking at Boken Jidai Katsugeki Goemon, which is the PS2 game where they made him look like a Dragon Ball character.
Yeah,
and they gave him he made his tiger a little cute cat buddy.
Yeah, that was a PS2 game, and then there was like a GBA game that had that new age kind of anime thing going on. So I mean, like I said, they were clearly not satisfied with where, you know, that it had to get more trendy or something. You know, they had to do more with it. So I guess that was kind of the first, you know, the first signs that it was, you know, on its way out. But luckily, it got this one last kind of more proper Goemon game before it did. It got to die with dignity, I would say, insofar as a franchise that features a fat guy in a tutu with magical farts could die with their dignity. This does the job. I mean, it's very reminiscent of the third Super Famicom Gunbare Goemon game, in that you've kind of got an overworld, although it's isometric kind of perspective instead of the Zelda top-down, but, you know, an overworld that you explore and talk to townspeople and some fetch questy kind of stuff. And then nested in that is some kind of dungeons that are 2D side-scrolling levels. The big difference, I guess, with this is just that it's a lot lighter on the 2D scrolling bits. They're kind of backloaded. You don't see much of them till the end. And even then, they're kind of very heavily leveraged around some of these touch elements they put in, because of course early DS game, you know, within the first year of its life, had to be a fair amount of touch stuff. As far as I know, blowing into the microphone doesn't do anything, but I never did try that. Perhaps it did, given the time. But, you know, it have these little interactive elements. Like, for instance, you might sort of be able to jump on top of an arrow that's in a bow, and you pull the bow back with the touch screen and then fire it at the correct time into a target, so that then you'll cross a chasm and, you know, keep jumping and all that. There's these sort of elements where you're going to be using the D-pad and buttons to control the character, so it's not a stylus kind of game, but at the same time, every now and again, you're going to be sort of, you're reaching in with one of your thumbs to touch these little interactive elements. And I mean, like I said, they're probably more obtrusive than I'd like, you know, because being that touchscreen has long since ceased to be a novelty, you know, 11 years hence. But they're still fundamentally, you know, pretty good, those levels. I just wish there was more of it, really. You know, like I said, it's a bit of a sketch of a game, this. It feels like, you know, they've got all the ingredients for something really good, like some of the best Goemon games. But, you know, maybe, you know, they were kind of getting it out early in the DS. It's like that's something that Goemon did a lot back then. You know, like, you know, the first one, Super Famicom, was very early in that game, that system's life, and the PS2 game. For whatever reason, Konami used to have this approach of like, just, oh, a new system's coming out, get something Goemon on it, you know, which is really that really feels like a long time ago. But, you know, it's a little bit half-baked, but, you know, it's got the charm of Goemon with the art style, even more so. It's probably the prettiest Goemon game there ever was. It's got the great music, quite a lot of familiar tunes for me, having played so many other Goemon games, but the actual instrument quality is probably as good as it ever got on Nintendo systems anyway. So it was a lot of fun, and it was kind of sad to see it off. It really wanted to feel like, yeah, this is my Goemon journey has ended now.
I mean, and the other thing I should mention is the Impact boss battles. It's a bit different from that. Normally, when you have a boss battle with Impact, the giant robot, for these sort of Godzilla fights, it would be kind of first person in the cockpit kind of view. But in this, you are going on in the foreground, holding a DS, controlling the Impact in the background using a touchscreen keypad, and you know, obviously it's like an amusing little kind of visual thing. And sometimes there are things going on that will affect, like, you know, you actually have to keep up with the fight as going on with the D-pad, you know. So like if the fight starts sort of veering off into one direction and you don't keep up, like, he loses the wireless range or whatever, so you can't control it anymore. And yeah, there's items on there that you can collect that might charge up a special meter or regain some health and stuff. And so it's less immediate than the first person battles, but I thought it was a cool way to actually put a new spin on that, because at this point I played a hell of a lot of games with those battles in, and they're really cool. They're kind of like Punch Out-ish to an extent, but at times also like more like what you might see in a shooter as well, like a corridor shooter, like a space area or something, kind of combined into one. It's a really interesting combination of things, those Impact boss battles. But this was a way to do something different with it, and, you know, also a way, of course, to, you know, get that DS touchscreen usage in there. And they're pretty fun too. So, you know, like I said, they, even though it's not the best Goemon game, you know, on a Nintendo platform, I wouldn't say, but they at least managed to kind of right the ship before it went off into the sunset or whatever.
Before Goemon was executed for attempting to kill Hideki Hayakawa.
Before the series was boiled in a patchy slot thing to death or whatever.
Death by patchy slot. That's how we're all gonna go.
Yeah. After the break, you can boil with us in the patchy slots, because it's time for your listener mail. It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review. As Divine Hearts on Wii U. It's Don Koopman. Of course, I mean, you knew it was Don Koopman. I knew it was Don Koopman. The game is called As Divine Hearts. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, anyway. I know these days it's hard to find a Wii U game, let alone one that doesn't have space-bound animals, a terrible control scheme, and awful level design. Thankfully, we have Kemco around to port a mobile RPG to the system. Yes, that's as depressing as it sounds. If you're looking for a game that's okay and competent, who better than Don Koopman to be your guide?
And Kemco to provide you.
I didn't even know Kemco was... I didn't know they were still around.
Yeah, that surprised me too.
Wow. Next up, we have a preview, Axiom Verge on Wii U, by Alex, Zach, and Neil. Zach and Neil took a turn on the Wii U build of Axiom Verge at PAX East 2016 and compared it with existing versions. We also get a fresh look at the game from series neophyte Alex, who thinks it's Metroid, but totally not Metroid at the same time. Watch him spontaneously explode into flames in this preview. It's a good thing we have this game coming out, John. You know why?
Why?
Because there's definitely no other Metroid games coming out anytime soon that we need to talk about. At all.
Definitely not. I mean, there's none that I know of that we need to talk about ever.
Ever.
You know, I mean, there's nothing.
I bet there will be one coming up that we won't even know is going to happen. It's going to release one day and then we'll have to talk about it. But until then, it doesn't exist.
Nope. I mean, theoretically, even if one did release, we definitely shouldn't talk about it.
I'm not going to make that jump just yet.
We have a preview of Monster Hunter Generations for 3DS by Alex Galafi. If you're an old hand at Monster Hunter like me, pun intended, you'll want to know what's new in Monster Hunter Generations. Alex is here to tell you just that, while at the same time describing how terrible he is at the game. Right, Alex, you were distracted by your moves recharging.
It's an old hand if I've ever heard.
Right. And we have a preview of Tumblestone for Wii U by Neil Ronahan. Sure, this looks like a Tetris clone, but Neil is here to tell you that Tumblestone may very well be the title that takes the summer of no games by storm. Well, at the very least, it's got online leaderboards, which is apparently too much to ask from Nintendo themselves these days. The struggle is real.
It's the summer of too hot, TWO, for games, to be fair.
Yeah. All right.
Too all hot this, all this, and more leaderboards aren't on NintendoWorldReport.com, just like at Nintendo. But for real news, you can go to NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back for the 10th anniversary listener mail special, which would be true if any of the email picked here were based on the fact this is the 10th anniversary. They weren't. But you could send us your email where you can wish us a happy anniversary or a send. Or in fact, Greg, you actually have some codes for our European listeners. So I'm going to let you pick the criteria for which they are awarded.
So, yeah, I bought the most recent Friends of Nintendo Humble Bundle, the first one to actually come to Europe. The original Humble Bundle for Nintendo did not. I've got Europe-specific codes for a few games that I'd already bought, some of which I spoke about on the show before. So I've got Affordable Space Adventures, which I've only ever mentioned in passing because I played through it super gradually in co-op, so there was never like a point where I played a big chunk of it in one go, but it's a great game. James has spoken about it, of course. So that's one code I've got. I've got Freedom Planet for Wii U, which of course is the Sonic style game I spoke about a little while ago. And then I've got Shantae and the Pirate's Curse for Wii U, and then separately for 3DS as well. So four codes, and we're looking to give them away now that the bundle has ceased. You know, that's it for the good cause that it served. If you could, any European listeners that have got specific memories that they'd like to share about the show over the past 10 years, send it in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, put in a request for which code you'd like, and we'll get it to the first takers.
See, this is what you get for listening Sunday night, or I guess early Monday morning in Europe.
Yeah, Monday morning commute. You know, start thinking about those memories while you're caffeinating yourself.
Again, you can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I also want to mention something else that came through the RFN email inbox. When I took over the show, a long time ago now, one of the objectives we had was to replace the icon we use for the show, not least of which because Apple wants a minimum-sized icon to be featured on the iTunes page, and that's one way we can pick up listeners. If you want to give us a gift for our birthday, suggest us to your friends, like, rate, and subscribe, or whatever nonsense I'm supposed to say here. But the icon thing sort of fell by the wayside, which is a bummer, and that was on me. However, we had some really nice submissions, but there was one that really blew us away. It was from Connor, who did some graphic design art professionally. Working with him on how he wants us to, you know, to mention him. He didn't really give us anything to go with on that front because I want to recognize his work. But if you look at the icon for this episode, you will see the new one. And in fact, it is now reflected on the Nintendo World Report page. James, edit this out if it doesn't get done by Sunday. Haha. And on the iTunes store. I really dig this icon. It looks really cool. The old one was really just kind of a logo, and this is much more of a, you know, design, and
it's like a bit of a coat of arms, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it kind of like the Owen Don armband things they had going on. See, bringing it back around. I really really like it. And so, Connor, thanks if you're listening to this. Hey, I sent you an email. Go ahead and take a look at that one. And of course, as always, we want to thank Perry, who wrote our music. You can see more of his stuff at Bluff's Custom Music. It's in the credits at the bottom of every episode show notes. There's a link. You can click it. He's done some really cool stuff. But that's it for the 400 stuff, because now it is time for listener mail, and I have the first email. So the first email is from, I need to open it up, Nick writes, like many people, I often have trouble falling asleep. Studies usually show that one should not use bright screens just before bedtime, but I've found that sometimes certain video games can help me get sleepy. Last fall, for instance, I used a replay of the Ace Attorney trilogy to help me shut out the world and get some sleep. This only works three plays, though, because new Ace Attorney games can keep me up all night. For long overseas flights, I'll often use Pokemon post-game activities, such as breeding, to induce drowsiness. Are there games that help you sleep? The key for me seems to be that the game must be interesting enough to distract me from the world, but slow-paced enough to help me relax. I transitioned to kind of a nice, gentle voice for people who use this show to fall asleep.
Yeah,
any of those that
you know personally? Maybe every day when you brush your teeth, you see one of those.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was dying. You know,
I was on death's door. Stop being so dramatic.
We can't all just skip the show when we're not feeling well. Because then John would host and the apocalypse would happen.
Oh, you're just on the wrong side of history, James. Anyway, I have a cheat answer for this because it is technically sort of a video game, but sort of not. Sound Voyager for the GBA was one of the bit generations of games. That were made back there by primarily by Skip. I think Q Games did Digidrive, but Skip did everything else, didn't they? That came out on GBA in 2005, and then there were some updated versions put on WiiWare, DSiWare in the years hence. But this was, you know, it had some like visualizing, but basically you were just meant to play it with headphones. As an audio only game where you were kind of locking different kind of tracks of sound into place, you know, so it's kind of like, well, I can hear it coming out of the right ear, so I need to move to the right to kind of lock it into place so it's equal in both ears, and then another kind of sound is fading in and you find your way to that's locked in the right place, and they start layering on top of each other into this kind of weird trancey kind of experience. So yeah, that was that's kind of what I used that game for, was drifting off a little bit, because like I said, the bright screens part you don't have to worry about because you don't even have to look at it, so that's why it's a bit of a cheat, but it worked
nice.
I actually have used the Ace Attorney games for this, I actually deal with insomnia a lot. My general answer really is, and this is something I picked up when I was a lot younger, is I just have to stay up until I can't stay up anymore.
You'd stay up making soap?
Something along those lines, yeah. Like, I'd stay up, and it's kind of a bummer, because what happens is if you try to go to bed, you just can't go to sleep. It becomes psychological, and you really can't sleep because you're thinking about it. So I really just have to stay up until I'm just done.
Yeah, you hit a wall, and then that's that. Yeah.
So a lot of times I play games to get to the wall. I really just push myself up against it. So it would be something that is mentally exhausting, something that really pushes me hard. But when I can't sleep, you know, I'm in bed at this point, and the only thing you can do is get out of bed and not think about it. If anybody who deals with insomnia regularly knows that, like, you're staying in bed and trying to go to sleep is a fool's errand. The Ace Attorney trilogy actually has come up a couple times where it's just like, okay, I'm going to sit in my study and just crank away on this game for a little while, and then see if that clears my head enough that I can sleep. I've also used... what was that game? JRPGs in general work okay, but a lot of times I'll get into a riff and I'll just start running. Yeah. So like, I had a problem sleeping the other night, and I thought, well, I'll just play a little bit, you know, a little bit of Bravely Second, and what ends up happening is I got caught And it's like, well, near the boss, I'll beat this boss. And then it was like, oh, okay, I've gone like half an hour. I should have tried to go back to sleep by now.
Yeah, yeah, there's a problem with the games that kind of trigger a compulsion to kind of do, like, yeah. one more little bit, you know. I can't play Picross before bed because I'm just going to, okay, finish a puzzle. I could finish another one, you know.
That's why you should do the Pokemon Picross free to play stuff, because you can't unless you spend
money. Finish another one.
Right?
Yeah.
So that
is the before bed Picross that basically.
The game basically takes your keys, tells you to call the taxi. Yeah.
I'll tell you when
I've had enough.
So yeah, so stuff like that, Pocket Card Jockey, I can't, or RPGs I think are pretty bad also, just because one more battle, and you know, oh, okay, yeah, I'm close to this place.
You very much can, but you really shouldn't.
Like I picked it up with the intention of just trying to generate, like, I was like, I'm going to get a 5-fight combo, and then I'm going to call it for the night. Because that requires you get at least 2 fights more than you should be able to get, unless you do some tricky stuff. I thought, well, that'll be good. And then I ended up realizing I had reached near the end of the dungeon. Like, well, I'll just keep going. But to your point, like, Owendon 2 would be terrible. Not just because it's loud and flashy, but because it's the ultimate, just one more. Just one more hit. Just one more hit, I'll be fine. I can do this, I'll be good.
Right. Oh, I failed, but I was so close.
Yeah, that's the worst. That's the worst when you're close. I mean, this isn't anything to do with
the music was fading out when I failed.
This isn't anything to do with going to sleep, but there was a bit of affordable space adventures where he was doing it co-op, and we had a way of trying to solve a bit. And the first time we tried it, we almost did it. So it's like, this has got to be right. This has got... And, 40 tries later, it's just going backwards until eventually we get it right again. It's, oh god, I wish that had been what I'd done, but there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, mine... it's go ahead.
Oh, just I was gonna say the games that put me to sleep usually are because maybe I'm a little bit bored, but Virtue's Last Reward I was not a super big fan of, but it's one of those kind of Ace Attorney-ish games where there's a lot of reading, not a whole lot of action. There's not a whole lot compelling you to push further other than a bit of story, right? So that's a pretty good choice, I guess.
And it takes a while to clear a room, so you're not likely to go, just one more room.
Like, right,
a room is an investment. It's like, it's 15 to 20 minutes. So when you clear a room, it's a good break point.
Yeah, and Citizens of Earth also, I've fallen asleep on, like, trying to start, and I can't because the beginning is pretty slow. Or maybe it's not, maybe I just started it too late, but I can't, I don't think I got to even, like, a decent battle so far. Ugh. It's just trying to, I picked up the mom and the brother as my party members, and that's basically it. I was like, oh, okay, time for bed.
Generally speaking, my go-to at this point is an audiobook. It's something where you can kind of half turn your brain off, because ultimately a lot of the people who consume audiobooks consume them doing something else, and it's good for that. And you're not, I mean, you have to be careful what your audiobook is, you know. It's, you don't want to do something that's going to be read by like, you're not going to do Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because the read of that is, you know, really heavily comedy driven, and I'm blanking on who does it. But like, you do something that's kind of have kind of a gentleness to it. Like, it's kind of a somber read. It's for games, I guess, for me, it's just, if I'm going to do it, it's just to distract myself. So
yeah, I mean, for me, game soundtracks can be pretty good for going off to sleep, because you're typically you're not dealing with vocals. I tend to find vocal songs, like, even if they're not necessarily really upbeat or anything, not as good for drifting off. Ambient stuff, instrumental, that's good to drift off. You play Zelda dungeons, you know, that kind of thing. It is a good choice. Although it does remind me once where I fell asleep with my MP3 player on, and there was an old episode of Radio Trivia in there that it just must have shuffled onto. There was one where I was on there, and evidently my own voice woke me up. after feeling disorientated for a little while, the biggest thing, the scariest part of it was, oh my god, I sound younger. Oh, that is the worst aging moment I've ever had in my life. It was like 5 years ago or whatever. I sound different. That's terrifying. So don't do that. Don't do that. Don't fall asleep with your own voice from 5 years previous on there, because it will wake you up and you will realize your own mortality, and that's never a good recipe for falling back to sleep.
Yeah, try falling back asleep after that, sure.
Don't get into the podcast game. You'll just get backstabbed by your former co-host, and it's just, don't do it. It's a bad, then you'll never sleep, because you'll think, he's out making another show right now. after he said, no, I don't have time for this. I'm sorry. Wait, what were we talking about again? We were talking about the next email. Guillaume.
Yes, Manny writes, hey guys, I have two questions. One, if you are a third-party developer or publisher who is not currently developing a game for Nintendo, how would you react to the announcement of NX releasing next March? And two, what are the chances that NX is revealed in a US venue instead of Japan? Thanks for a great podcast.
I guess for the first question, we have to ask, do we think the major publishers knew? And I would assume they did.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe some of them had better information than others, but I mean, speaking for myself, like that was a large part of my expectations anyway. I said, when we did the prediction show, I said, you know, I think it's a toss-up between whether it ends up maybe before Christmas or at the very end of the fiscal year when they would really have to have it done. You know, so the fact that the coin falls on tails, it doesn't shock you. You know, like I felt like that was always a very strong possibility, and I would imagine that a lot of developers and publishers probably would have seen it that way, even if they didn't have specific information, but then they may have done. So, you know, I doubt there was a lot of shock involved. I know it is unusual for a console to come out at that time of year. Typically it's been handhelds that have come, you know, like 3DS came out at that time of year. But of course that goes back to the old chestnut of we don't know what it is, how handheld or console-y it is yet. You know, some people might say that's, you know, augurs in the direction of it being more of a sort of, you know, handheld type of thing perhaps. I think it's probably just a matter of the practicalities of the situation. But no, I mean, I don't think that in itself would have made too many sort of waves in the development community and things. I mean, I guess one of the interesting things is how much would they look at it as trying to avoid some of the things that are coming out in the shopping season, you know, going into Christmas and stuff, VR, the revised consoles and stuff. Do they look at it as like it wants to get out of the way of those, or is it just that that's Nintendo's schedule, that's how long it's going to take for them to create a worthwhile launch lineup, you know, so that's how it's happening. Again, they may have more information on that to kind of make those sorts of judgments than we would.
Right.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that if you're a third-party publisher who's not currently engaged in Wii U, Nintendo had let you know when they knew that, hey, we're not going for the holiday season. And if their intention was to hit holiday and they had to push it back, and especially that decision was made really close to the investors' briefing and they didn't have time to communicate ahead of it because they had to mention it during the briefing. I mean, they quite possibly legally had to mention it during the briefing. Because investors, you know, they need to know where their money's going to come from, and you have to disclose that kind of information. It's possible that maybe the timing was bad and they couldn't communicate it. I would hope that if that was the case, after the briefing, their high-level contacts immediately turned around and reached out and said, hey, let me explain what's happening. Let me explain why we're doing this. And let's talk about how you fit into this arrangement. Because that's really what they need to be doing. And if it was such that they couldn't talk about it ahead of time, I hope they made sure to have those conversations, not just what, not just why, but how it's going to work, how they can help these third parties bridge the gap to get there.
Yeah.
And to some extent, it may be advantageous for the third parties, because if, let's say they were planning on putting their big holiday games on NX, just for the sake of argument, play devil's advocate here, they were going to have to learn a new system this holiday season and port a game to it that they're already making for at least two, probably three other systems. Now they have time, a little bit of extra time, to sit there and make sure the NX version works and that it is effective and that it doesn't have weird NX-specific bugs because it was a rush job port, and to get familiar with the hardware when they're not under the gun of the holiday season. They're still under the gun of the launch date, but they can get their other versions out into the wild and react accordingly and have a team that is spun up specifically to make sure the NX version works that can be working with what was essentially the gold version that went to prod, because that's work coming out, went into the market in, you know, October or November, versus trying to rush a port of that version onto a platform they don't know. So for them, it may actually be slightly more convenient, even if it does discourage them from porting some marginal sellers that they thought they might get people who are buying the console and say, well, I'll buy this whatever that EA is putting out to go with it. But there's not a ton of that mid-tier game coming out of the big publishers right now, so ultimately, they may not have those things to go with anyway. I would say that, you know, just as long as Nintendo's been in communication, I think they'll be fine.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the interesting sort of component of the question is about, you know, the people who, you know, don't have anything in the pipeline right now, you know, how it would change their perception. So, you know, like, I guess they would be people who wouldn't have been that plugged in the first place, presumably, you know, if they're not already sort of developing stuff for the next Nintendo, well, a game for Nintendo is the wording in Manny's question. So that might even be people who are just not developing for the current systems, not developing right for the next system either. You know, how does this, I guess, you know, maybe you could say it's always, does it confirm, you know, for them that Nintendo's like not trying to compete with everybody else and they're just trying to do their own thing, and that means that it's not somewhere for them to go? Or, you know, or does it say kind of, you know, what, some of the practical issues you mentioned, like that actually we could fit something in there because it's not just going to get totally crushed by everything else? I don't know. That I think the bigger thing rather than the release date is the nature of the platform. And that is still the big mystery.
Caveat imperator here.
Yeah. Always.
When you know what you're actually buying, buyer beware. So Guillaume, what do you think?
I just, I don't know. I can't think like a developer. I can't. yeah, you would assume. Well, the way I see it, everything gets pushed back so much now. Can you really, like, I struggle to think of a big game that would actually, I don't even know. Like, we haven't seen E3 yet. We don't know what's coming. Stuff at the last E3 still hasn't released.
Yeah.
Mass Effect Andromeda just got pushed back.
No, I mean, that's where the whole second Christmas thing came from, is, you know, stuff getting pushed back, but they still have to deliver it in the fiscal year. Really, yeah, they get that kind of obligation that you have to kind of live up to that promise. You know, that's how March turned into that, you know, and I guess Nintendo kind of got out in front of it a bit more than you might normally do, you know, with Zelda being delayed and all that kind of stuff. Although, again, I mean, I would think that it may have been, in terms of the timing, to James' point, you know, it may have been quite a down-to-the-wire decision because, you know, that huge booth at E3, you do wonder whether that was just hedging. You know, if we want to take, if the system's ready and we want to take it to E3, we'll have the space to do it. If not, we're going to have a lot of Zelda-related stuff to dress it up with, and that's about it. Mm.
One thing that could potentially happen, not that EA has shown a whole lot of interest in the NX, but, you know, the Mass Effect 3 situation where they ported Mass Effect 3 to the Wii U, and almost immediately, or even before it was released, the trilogy was announced for the other consoles, and that was not coming to Wii U, so that was just a bad look, and I have to wonder if they were planning on having Mass Effect 3 out much sooner, but then, for whatever reason, took longer to port than they expected, or the team, you know, all of a sudden it was less of a priority when they saw the Wii U sales. like, maybe the Mass Effect 3 Wii U port was meant to be, released much earlier and not so close to the trilogy. And, it might screw up business plans that way. But I can't imagine that a publisher would be like, oh, well, I guess I'm not, you know, I'm canceling these games.
It kind of fundamentally affects the way you look at the viability of a platform. I can't see it being that kind of level of impact.
Right.
Well,
right.
And it may say that this specific game, we're going to hold off because we know we're going to do a Game of the Year edition. So we'll do that one for NX. Mm, we'll just wait. We'll wait on doing, you know, is there a Batman game this year? I feel like there is. There isn't. No, because the other one just came out. But I'll use Batman as an example, even though there isn't one. If there were a Batman game this year, maybe they would say, well, let's wait, because we were thinking about rushing it out there for NX, but let's just wait and We won't have one at system launch, but when we do the inevitable game of the year, even though no one will give us a game of the year award, the game of the year edition, and as voted on by Rocksteady's development staff, we will we'll release that one on NX, and that will be give us even more time to play with making sure this version runs right, that our NX technology is understood, that the dev engine works, that we understand the development kit, that we can QA this damn thing. And then our publisher knows how to work with Nintendo to sell this stuff. I mean, ultimately, Nintendo needs to be out there putting their best face on this situation, regardless of whether or not this was the plan all along or if this is just something they recognized they needed to do. And that's a platform holder's job, is to go out there and really represent their platform and say, like, yo, I know this is a weird date to launch a console, but, and then explain why it can work. And really, you know, do the sales job. Make people understand, like, hey, this is where we think you can be on this system. And, you know, it's not port buying like we had written about last week, but it is, you know, making sure that you seem viable. But there was the other question that... Yeah.
It's an interesting question about what the chances that NX is revealed in a US venue instead of Japan, because obviously the last time they revealed the console for first time with Wii U, you know, that was kind of pre... You know, it was their old approach to E3, wasn't it? You know, before right. The digital events and all that. And then, yeah, perhaps their approach to E3 is still evolving, you know, the way that now that you know, we're down to one game and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, there's a chance that it's not exactly revealed in one venue at all, you know, that it is revealed through some sort of video, and then you have a whole bunch of events that are you've done in different places in the world, coordinated through the regional branches. I mean, it's I think it is possible that it could be in a US venue rather than Japan, because that's generally been, you know, the way it's been at E3s in the past. But this time we know it won't be E3. You know, you start wondering, maybe it could actually be back in Japan, you know, more like the old days or something. But I would vote on it just sort of being abstracted from any particular venue anywhere right. In the world.
I guarantee you that after the announcement, or probably before, actually, probably the day of the announcement, but it'll probably start a few hours before it with everybody under blood oath embargoes, that there will be events in, I'm just going to name cities, Tokyo, London, New York, or Los Angeles. It's going to be one or the other. It might be in San Fran, but Nintendo really digs, you know, those cities. It probably won't be at their headquarters, although it could be their Seattle offices, I mean, or Redmond. And probably one other city. I don't know, Greg. I mean, they do a lot of their. Do they do a lot of events outside of? They did one in the Netherlands, I thought, not that long ago for the 3DS.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing more kind of on the continent stuff these days. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for a big system thing like that, it's hard to say, you know, because
right. It'll be somewhere you can fly to easily in Europe.
Basically. Yeah, exactly. Whatever, you know, it's going to be easiest, I would have thought, for that kind of thing. But I would have thought, you know, if they're trying to push it out there in a big way, you know, they're going to want to try and reach a few places beyond the really obvious stuff, like, you know, London, New York, LA, you know, so, and obviously their Japan operations. I just think it'll be really interesting to see how they handle it, because it's going to be the first system reveal since they've, you know, taken this different sort of attack with E3 and the media in general. So, is it possible they could do something like more orthodox, like kind of go back and feel like, oh, well, actually, for a system launch, we need to do things sort of more the old way. I guess that's possible, but I'm not necessarily expecting that.
Yeah, I was just speaking in terms of like press hands-on time, interviews time, stuff like that, like the day of, because they're going to want stories.
But you're talking about, it's going to be sort of presumably worldwide, near simultaneous. But whereas normally E3 is kind of, you know, is the thing, and then you have these kind of events that are, you know, based off E3. you know, it's those demos. It's a, yeah, there's an echo effect. You know, it's like, well, they will arrange for the, you know, the London media to go and this or any other places, whatever. This would be, this could be, I think, different in that it could be more coordinated, more of a kind of global rollout strategy from the start rather than, you know, E3 centric and then these sort of satellite things that come after the fact. But that would be a lot to coordinate. So
yeah,
I do worry about that.
Sorry, and I can tell you that Nintendo of Canada knows things. It learns of things really, really late. Like they're not kept in the loop. Surprisingly, I mean, I know that, that's the way things are.
I wouldn't be terribly shocked if most of the people at Nintendo of America, or at least a significant portion of them, are largely in the dark. Not because they wouldn't trust their own people, but because there is this sense of, like, we need to keep this under wraps that's really deep right now. Because at this point, we had already kind of caught some of the outlines of Project Cafe. The 3DS had kind of already been tipped off. Like, they've really been really stonewall, like, just, you know, walled in all information. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the, especially if it's not going to be at E3, like, the marketing people are on the out right now, because it doesn't matter what the marketing team thinks right now. They don't need, you know, 10 months to come up with the marketing campaign. They're busy making logos.
Maybe they should consult the marketing team before naming the freaking thing.
Well, I mean, you can name it later. They haven't named, they totally could have not named the thing yet, but I'm not. What I struggle with is if they're going to tie it to something besides itself. There's a limited number of candidates. There is TGS, which they've basically never really been involved.
No, they've done stuff alongside it. Like, didn't they do? There wasn't there like a Wii Remote reveal that kind of tied a lot. It was alongside TGS, but it's not like they're a regular exhibitor at the show. They've never really done that.
I mean, there is. They could say this is a consumer electronics device and tie it to like CES, but that would be weird.
No, that's retro. I remember when
CES was
a big
deal
for video game coverage in the old magazines in the early 90s and stuff.
It really is, but like you could totally do that. I'm trying to remember what, for whatever reason, I'm blanking on what GameCom. I mean, you could tie it to
Yeah,
but like even then, like why they don't go? They don't really. I mean, they go there, but they don't really do anything there. They just kind of show off their E3 demos again. Like, there's not a lot of things they could tie it to, short of just doing their own thing. And to your point, if they're gonna do their own thing, they're gonna localize it for your region, which is because that's how they do their messaging now. And they talked about giving more autonomy to their regions as part of their reorg. So why wouldn't Shibata do a direct? Reggie do a direct? And then, you know, somebody out of Japan do the direct. I mean, Reggie and Shibata are now, you know, on the board of directors. Like
they're on the new auditing committee or whatever. Like, or
yeah,
well.
like they are important at this point. So, you know, why wouldn't you do it that way? Because then you can tailor the messaging. You can give, if you have dates or information that's region specific, you can use that. You can show any kind of branding that you're going to do that may be regional driven. You know, you could talk about this stuff in terms of that the local audience understands it, and feature games, if you're going to show off games, feature games in a way that may be most conducive to that region based on your understanding of them. If you're not going to tie it to an event, and there's a fairly limited number of events on the calendar right now they could tie it to, short of just saying, we're doing our own thing, deal with it, Space World's back, bitches. it kind of really only makes sense to do it the way they do everything else. And I mean, by and large, the really big directs, get pretty good viewership. Like, if they said, hey, we're going to have a direct, it's going to be the NX one, they're going to crash whatever server that thing's running on. Twitch is going to have problems. And they know that. And
yeah, I guess the bigger thing is, again, and get your caveat ready, it's like how much of it is something they feel like can be appreciated in video form, and how much of it is sort of experiential, and then how much do you want people, like, do you want, like, the impressions to kind of that of people that have played it hands-on to lead into the big blowout of video stuff, or do you want it to come after all that kind of stuff? You know, these are the sorts of questions they're going to have to ask themselves if they're going to, you know, just kind of not let it be. You know, it kind of gives them more freedom in a way, but it also gives them more decisions to make when if they do separate themselves from any particular event on the calendar. So, you know, they're going to have a lot of things to think about in terms of, you know, what way round is best to do these things and all that. But with it being Nintendo, you've got to think the hands-on experience is going to be a big part. So like you said, some sort of simultaneous hands-on or near-simultaneous hands-on events has got to be a big part of it to kind of, so it's not just abstract, it will be great, trust us kind of stuff.
Yeah, let the, because I mean, ultimately, when they do it at E3, only people who go to E3 got to play it. So do your media dump and then start your, you know, some point after that, start your ability to play this thing in stores and
yeah, you go to roll out.
Go to your PAX.
Of course, your... supposedly the Wii was very successfully kind of rolled out pre-launch to like bloggers or whatever. You know, that's the story, isn't it? You know, that yeah. They sort of targeted the right people to let them try it, and then it spread good word of mouth on the internet kind of thing. Yeah, I guess that could be another kind of, that kind of, but that would be, yeah, secondarily.
Let YouTubers play it.
It would be after the reveal, that kind of stuff.
It would be, it's going to be YouTube personalities, ultimately. Like, they're going to fly to Seattle and let play, they're going to shake Reggie's hand, and then they're going to play the NX. And I would be willing to bet money one of the major, I'm saying, you know, million plus subscribe YouTube gaming personalities will make the trip to Nintendo's offices in Washington and will play NX. They probably won't be able to film it. Maybe they'll get some footage shot by Nintendo people of them playing it and some screen capture, and they will be putting videos on their YouTube page within a week of the reveal.
I think it's pretty clear that the Nerdy Nums girl is going to get an exclusive access, and we're going to see some NX-shaped treats. It's going to be fantastic.
Greg, you have the next email.
Yeah, so Leroy this writes, one bit of Nintendo talk that I've seen fall completely out of usage this generation is the concept of Nintendo's, quote, Big Three, or Mario, Zelda, and Metroid. In the past two or three generations, this was a pretty widely accepted term used by gaming journalists, gamers, and Nintendo PR alike. With mainline Zelda's decline in sales and Metroid's inability to make a splash in its prime, it's easy to see why people no longer speak of these franchises in the same breath. Is it time for Nintendo to refocus their image and output around a new Big Three? Perhaps Mario, Splatoon, Pokemon, or Mario Kart, Smash, Fire Emblem? What would you consider Nintendo's current Big Three, or four or five, not only in terms of sales, but mindshare and potential for growth as well?
Has Nintendo PR actually referred to the Big Three? Because to me, I always thought it was kind of an invention of the gaming press.
I don't know if they've used the term, but they've definitely sort of like done. They've definitely sort of said in the same breath, Zelda, Mario, Metroid. Like they knew that was their three drivers, but I don't know if they've ever used that phrase.
Yeah. But like in the past two or three generations, I would say Nintendo has kind of already refocused their image around other
franchises. Yeah, I feel like that's more of a GameCube generation thing, obviously with the Metroid renaissance that happened around that time. After that, you know, even before Corruption came out on Wii, you know, it was already starting to shift in terms of all these other, you know, the Wii branding stuff, the Touch Generation stuff, as James mentioned before, they encompassed all these disparate things like brain training and the Dendogs and all this kind of stuff. You know, it was a diversification, you know, and obviously, you know, those three still had, you know, some of the most history. They still date back to
to pretty much the same point in time.
Right.
But yeah, so
that would be the reason to exclude Pokemon, even though Pokemon was outselling handily.
Well, and the other reason would be Pokemon has its own licensing company to govern its affairs and all that, so it's always treated a bit separately.
And Nintendo's only a co-owner, essentially.
Yeah, it's a bit separate. But yeah, I mean, in terms of commercial, you know, clout, Pokemon, you know, he's really way up there. That's again, it's not really the, I think the reason why those three get lumped together is mainly because of when the sort of the, when they came to prominence and the fact that most of them, although, you know, Metroid of course skipped a generation, but most of them have had had big games at the same, you know, you think of sort of like Link to the Past, Super Mario World and Super Metroid all coming out on the Super Nintendo, and then, you know, something like Metroid Prime, Wind Waker, Sunshine all came out pretty close together on GameCube, you know, I guess there's that kind of feeling about them. But you know, yeah, that's kind of broke down quite some time ago, I feel like. And of course, the fact that the fact that Metroid has been without a game of any sort for 6 years has obviously just driven the nail deep into the coffin. But it was been breaking there before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Nintendo right now is betting hard on Animal Crossing, on Miis, on Fire Emblem.
Like, with that being mobile.
They made three Fire Emblem games at the same time. Like,
Now it's one of the first Nintendo IPs to get to mobile. I mean, that shows you that it's definitely made some progress. But I also think it's probably like that's the kind of game that maybe they won't get in installed on as many people's phones, but that'll be the one that people will sink a lot of money into. That's where you're going to get the whales that will just keep giving them money over and over again. I mean, that's probably how they envision that series. But there's no doubt it's reached a higher level of recognition even to get into consideration for one of those five initial free-to-start apps.
Yeah. They may view it as their prestige title too, though. They may say, like, this is the one where we're going to show we know what the hell we're doing. It possibly even better than all these interlopers entering our games industry on these phones. It's really, it depends on how they view themselves kind of thing. But, you know, I think just based on the fact that Splatoon has a 50% attach rate in Japan, like,
It is astonishing, Splatoon, what Splatoon's done in Japan on that
50%
platform.
Attach rate? On 50%!
On that platform, in that genre, in Japan, new IP is staggering. I know we've said this many times before, but yeah, they've probably got very big plans for that in the future. I think that could well emerge as one of their biggest titles, whether you want to call it a big three or big whatever. You know, it's going to be prominent. And going off one thing I said last week, you know, when Nintendo say they're anticipating good, robust kind of downloadable revenue on Wii U to kind of somewhat offset the fact that they're slashing the sales forecast. So you've got to think if there's any realistic possibility of that paid Splatoon DLC is coming sometime in the fiscal year. Because
I hope so. I have a prediction bet on it.
They haven't done it. They haven't done it yet. And it would seem, like you said, the kind of the fever that they built up in Japan especially would seem like it's just waiting to... Obviously, you've got the new Amiibo that are coming with Callie and Marie. You know, that's one way they're kind of getting more out of it. But I think paid DLC's got to be coming, and especially because that's probably the easiest way they could get more money out of the Wii U at this point. It's not new games. It's, you know, especially a game that hasn't even had a single piece of paid DLC yet. That's low-hanging fruit.
I mean, you have things like Mario Maker, which it is a Mario game in and of itself, but it's kind of this experimental thing. I mean, I think Nintendo's goal, and you know, you mentioned on the Wii DS generation, it was really about these kinds of like broad horizon things, the blue ocean as the terminology they use. I think what we're gonna see is the paucity of titles available on their platforms really has sort of hurt them, and having essentially a diverse lineup of their own stable, and they have all the franchises to make it happen, and just making sure that they're all really given the, you know, I think Fire Emblem is instructive. They had a franchise that was not especially successful. It's an intelligence systems franchise, but still. And they really gave it the effort. They really sat down and reinvented and made it work in a way that really made that series do something different. Even though it was still at its core the same series, and it was wildly successful. I think what you'll see is you'll see them kind of reappraise some of their series that are kind of in the middle and say, what can we do with this franchise to push it over the top? What is the Fire Emblem event repeatable?
And
it may not be for some franchises. I mean, Fire Emblem has its own, you know, anime-ish appeal that is going to... It just can't get out of, Yoshi. Like, you're not going to make a Yoshi anime game with dating sims.
Woolly World managed to cross over 1 million sold worldwide, which isn't bad.
No, that's...
Considering, you know, it's not Splatoon, and
right.
You know, it's another platform, which is a pretty well-represented genre on a system with a small install base. I'm glad it did as well as it... I think that was pretty much the ceiling, probably.
So, James, when you say that you wouldn't make a Yoshi dating sim, clearly you haven't played my Twine game.
Twine is a mistake. It's nothing but trash. All right. Next email, I guess. This is actually our last email, and it is from... it's not our last email, but it will be our last email. Adam writes, "Dear Guillaume and friends, I love this show, but it's been going for a long-ass time."
How long exactly? Have we talked about how long it's been going recently?
I don't know. It's almost like I picked this email this week because of something like that. How much longer do you think each of you will continue on the show? Do you still remember the topics from your first show? Guillaume, why do you have a cassette player? Are you just that old-fashioned? Has ironic record collecting become old-fashioned only to be replaced with ironic cassette collecting? Will you record and edit an episode of the show on your sweet 2-cassette deck? Sincerely, a fan of firefighter calendars.
Oh, boy. So, yeah, these are plenty of Mitomo references.
if you want to see the cassette player,
yeah, I think the cassette player was used as chapter art for a Mitomo-related discussion.
Nice.
But, okay. So I don't have the cassette player anymore. I was trying to make a joke about what kids are into these days, and I made a joke about planking, but I couldn't make my character plank on anything but a flat surface, and I had a photo of a cassette player on my phone because I gave it away on FreeCycle, so it's gone. I don't have a sweet 2-cassette deck anymore, but I do have plenty of floppy disks that I can't use anymore. Maybe I should...
I'm going to go ahead and do a pause here and say, when do you think your last episode is going to be? After that, now. This is my last episode after that conversation.
Peace out,
everybody. It's been a fun ride.
I've already had one last episode, so, you know, I don't really think
and it was emotionally traumatic.
Now you get to live forever.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is going to be indefinite. I will say after the end of Civilization.
The heat death of the universe.
After it, you know, I mean, no one will hear it, but I will do an episode after the end of Civilization.
So how many years has it been for me? 292 was
four years
ago.
Four years.
Four years.
Oh my god. Okay. So I've been doing this for 4 years. I don't know. I've in my day job, I've shown a surprising inertia to change. So like I've been in the same place for a long time, so I can imagine. I guess I can imagine myself doing this for a while still.
That's good to hear, because I was worried you guys would be like, "This is my last show. Peace out."
There's always that concern.
There's always that concern when you put an email like this in, because we've had this question before. I'm like, "What if somebody says today and it's not a joke?"
Oh my god, that would be a dick move.
It would be, but maybe they just had an epiphany and they're just like, "I have to say it." I've had this conversation before. Do I want to keep doing the show forever? And it definitely, there are times where, you know, I just felt checked out of gaming and I was like, I don't know. But I always come back around. Like, there'll be a game that sort of like gives me energy, you know, and for example, Owen Don 2 today is giving me a lot of energy. I want to play not just Owen Don 2. I just want to go play games.
Oh, God, they're real. They're real. They're actually doing it right there.
Now I won't wet the bed. Thanks, guys. If you missed the first segment of the show, that's a really strange comment to just make. I apologize. But the if you weren't paying attention before, I bet you go back and listen to it now. The first topic question. God, I think our Greg, I think our well, you appeared on the show before I did.
Yeah, but the topic on my first episode, I think it's like I think Evan and all, they weren't on the show because but they were about to play Super Mario Galaxy or something like it was something like that. I think on episode 78 that was my first appearance, but I can't even really remember what happened on 82 that well.
Yeah, I mean. A lot of 82 was it being weird that we were on there and like awkward quietness and like I'm trying to I actually listened to it not terribly long ago because it's really brutal. It's a really brutal episode. like it's tough. But the thing is like we don't even actually go into the details of what we were playing. The show notes were super raw. I know at the point I was expected to still do like the forum update, and my answer every week was like, our forums are fucking nuts. I don't know what's going on in there, and like that was the answer consistently. And I would just read a thread, and everybody would be like, what, and then we just walk away and pretend like it didn't happen. Like that's the end of that. So I don't remember beyond that, except I introduced the segment and it was bad. I know I got a phone call in it, which was weird, and I had no idea how to handle it. And it was an odd experience as a show. It really was. So I think I just hunkered down and got through it.
Well, mine is not that long ago, so yes, I remember. The topic was actually probably me. You know, a getting to know you kind of thing. So
again, you were on before. You were regular, like the way I was on before. I was a regular too. So it depends which one you want to take as your first.
Yeah,
one.
Well, I guess my official first episode is the one I'm thinking of, and it's probably actually like it's not gruesome. Like I re-listened to it, and it's probably one of my best episodes because I was trying so hard to be like. I was trying so hard, and now I know better. But
it's John's shown you the way of casual indifference.
Yep, exactly.
So I'm actually looking at the talkback for 82. Amongst the things was somebody noted that if you let Johnny talk, he will take over the whole show, which is true. Yeah. And imploring Greg, you and I to talk more, at which point I just said, I don't know, at some point I'll just start shouting and grief my own podcast. Guess what? That happened.
Prophetic.
And at some point in the comments, apropos of nothing, apparently, I start describing the Musi X codec, so apparently that came up. So, like I said, just a block of me describing it in there. I don't know what the hell is going on. This whole internet thing is a mistake. We just need to be rid of it. I think that's the answer. So if you can, if you have the master off button, please go ahead and press it. That's going to do it for email this week. As always, you can send your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I would say it's been like that for 10 years, but that's not technically true. It's been like that for like 9 or something along those lines. But it still works. We still check it. One last thing to note, we are 2 weeks out from our retroactive of Castlevania Rondo of Blood. We will not be doing it next week. We'll be doing it the week after. So that'll be episode 478. You can play that TG16 Classic right now on the Wii Virtual Console. And if you're not excited, remember, there's door sound effects in the music. So you should probably be excited. And that will do it. Greg, what is our end music this week?
Well, Iron Music has chosen to be appropriate for the occasion. So, as you know, as we said, RFM was born out of E3 2006, which was,
and it will die out of E3 2006.
Yeah, it was the botched PS3 reveal and all the Wii stuff and all that. But one of my favourite things that came out of that E3 was the Smash Brothers Brawl theme song composed by Nobuo Uematsu, that really started the hype train rolling. Probably Nintendo's most extravagant hype train ever, I think it's fair to say.
Smash Certainly Brawl. Its longest.
The daily updates and all that. The game wouldn't come out till 2008, but this beautiful theme song made its debut 10 years ago at that E3, and I'm sure a lot of people have heard it, but there's nothing wrong with hearing it again, because it's pretty great.
Cool. And on that, it's been an awesome 10 years. I hope you all enjoyed Radio Free Nintendo. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
10 more years.
Oh, no, I was trying to make it sound like we were done.